Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. I am excited to have this conversation with you guys, to listen and seriously grab paper, some pens, coffee, whatever you need, sit back and get ready to absorb this information, coming together and collaborating, cooperating, compromising to come and find a beautiful consensus to better support the children that we serve. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am my mom and special educator. I have sat at both sides of that IEP table as a parent and a professional. And over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a download, a follow, a like, or a share. Let's get ready to strategize special education style. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm excited today. We are talking with Dr. Halpern, and she's going to introduce herself, but we're talking about social media, mental health, specifically with our teens, our kids, our vulnerable youth. And I hope everybody is listening up, because this is a hot topic that parents and even professionals have a lot of questions and concerns about. So thank you for joining us and welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like to give us a little bit about who you are, what you do, and how you came to focus on social media and mental health?
Sure. I'm Dr. Jacqueline Halpern. I'm the director of the SOAR program for psychotherapy and testing at Washington Behavioral Medicine Associates in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And so my days are a combination of therapy, of reading and supervising testing reports, of supervising my staff and working with families. And just to tell you a little bit more about our practice, we're an integrated practice. We have psychiatry, we have therapy, we have testing. We are doing a lot all the time to help families. And that's really how I became an expert for social media. There was a need. It wasn't something that I knew a lot about not that long ago, but we started to get requests for articles. We started to hear from families that they were having concerns about their children's social media use, and it required me, therefore, to start learning and researching.
Isn't that always the way, right? There's a need and you're like, all right, let's do this. I see this. And I'm sure parents are coming to you and you do excellent work of just a lot of questions and concerns. So let's jump into that world of social media. How does it relate to kids that are both neurotypical and neurodivergent? Or does it? I mean, is there a difference?
Yeah, all kids are impacted by social media. That's actually a wonderful question. You know, it is so prevalent. It is very hard to get away from. And even though most of the social medias have an age limit where you're not supposed to join before a certain age, kids are getting on at all ages. And even things like YouTube are technically social media. So we have little ones, really little ones, watching videos at young ages. So all kids are impacted. The way that their brains are impacted may vary based on whether they are neurotypical or neurodivergent. We actually see some more positives with our neurodivergent kiddos in terms of allowing them to jump on and have a space where it might be easier for them to interact without having that face-to-face interaction, where they can stop and pause and think more about what they want to say and how they want to say it. The screen kind of creates just a lower anxiety in them that makes being who they are come to life. And also, you know, they're able to find their passions and their interests in others like them in a way they may not in their day-to-day social interaction. And in many cases, this is very regulating. Going into the screen, this is social media, but you know, screen time in general, video gaming, a lot of these kids, their sensory needs are really met by being on the screen. At the same time, those neurodivergent kiddos may be more vulnerable to screen addiction. They may be more vulnerable to cyberbullying. And so while there are benefits, there are also risks. And that's the same for neurotypical kids. There are benefits and there are risks to getting on that screen.
So how do we start the conversation about social media with our kids?
So like any conversation, the earlier we start, the better, you know, around these hard topics. If we start with a little one, you know, you can watch, I'm going to watch with you. I'm going to find that video for you and turn it on. If an inappropriate ad pops up, it's, you know, oh, I'm going to turn that off. Let's not watch that. You know, sometimes these things that come up, they're not things that are for kids. And it's starting early with something like that, and then moving as our kids get older into really explaining what those dangers are. You know, that there are people out there who may want to take advantage. There are cyber bullies, that we leave a digital footprint with everything that we do. Things don't just disappear, even if we think that they do. That the content on social media may not be accurate. We might be looking at false news, so to speak, or very polarized content. And we have to start telling our kids, you know, very early on what this may look like, and then building at an age appropriate level.
And if I may, I have a question, and I don't know if you may have the answer or not. So when we talked about neurodivergent kids, and you said that it was provided a space for them to kind of be more social, have a pause, and be able to interact, is there any correlation of that then being able to transfer to face-to-face, like in real life, these skills, or it may be too soon to know?
That's a great question. I haven't specifically seen research on that. You know, there is a huge world out there. So, you know, I'm talking specifically, I should say, about autistic kiddos when I say this, but where they can find other autistic individuals and autistic adults who have been there and experienced and who really can become mentors if they're in a space where they can guarantee safety and where parents can help them guarantee that safety. And, you know, when that's happening, if kids are starting to feel connected, if they're starting to feel confident, what we know in general is that self-esteem will start to translate. If they're less anxious and less depressed because they have a sense of well-being and a sense of who they are and they feel a part of community, that's likely to transfer over. But I haven't seen any direct research on, you know, if they're socializing on social media, does that then carry over directly to real life interactions?
I was just curious. So can you talk a little bit about the dangers? You've kind of mentioned them, but then how do we get our kids to understand these dangers? Because, you know, we're the parents, and according to our kids, we don't know anything. So how do we get them to, you know, start to understand that, yes, there's some great positives, but then there's also some dangers?
Yeah. So, you know, you touched on something that actually we kind of joke about it, but our kids kind of think we don't know anything. And when it comes to social media, we might not compare to them. When it comes to screens, we might not compare to them. We generally grew up in a completely different generation where we didn't have this. And so a lot of times our kids are more screen fluent than we are at a very, very early age. And so they may know more about each of the social media platforms. They may know more about what's going on. They may even know how to trick us, because often that information is out there and easy to find, and they're finding loopholes. And so what this really comes down to more than anything is building a foundation of trust. So in our practice, one of the things that we always, always highlight is starting as early as possible to build trust with our kids and to create a foundation of, you know, I'm here for you, to really use attachment as a foundation for connection. And when our kids trust us, when they feel seen, when they don't feel like they're going to be judged or get punished for every conversation they have or every mistake that they make, they're more likely to listen to us in general. If we're not simply trying to control them, if we're not punishing them, if we're not judging everything that they do, when we come to them with a concern, they're a lot more likely to take it seriously. So this isn't social media specific, but we really want to help parents create that foundation of trust to move away from, you know, okay, you did something wrong, I'm going to punish you, or to jump to a quick conclusion or to offer a judgment on their child's behavior, but rather to say, come talk to me. Let's problem solve together. If there's something happening that's a concern in the house, you know, let's sit down and talk. Let's figure out a solution that works for both of us. Helping parents learn to co-regulate. When their kids are upset, rather than trying to talk them out of their feelings, be present for those emotions. When the kids are having a meltdown, being able to be there and say, I've got you. When that foundation is there, that trust is built. And when that trust is built, these conversations can happen, and our kids are a lot more likely to take us seriously.
That is beautiful. Thank you. So, and sometimes, you know, I think just as a mom of three, it's sometimes best practice and then it doesn't always go the way we want in a moment, but I like that co-regulation
more. And I think, you know, when parents don't get it right, it's really important to recognize we don't have to be perfect. Whether we're talking about social media or anything else, we're going to mess up in these conversations. We are going to have moments where we're dysregulated, we're upset, we say the wrong thing to our kid. We are not expecting any parent to be perfect. I teach this and I am far from perfect, but it is about really going back and repairing and modeling for our kids, taking responsibility. Hey, I was upset. I said something that I regret. I don't want to hold to that, or I treated you in a way that isn't okay and I'm sorry, and really trying to repair in that moment. And, you know, along with that, we talk about the 5-to-1 rule. You make one mistake, try for 5 positive interactions. They don't need to be big, but you want those positives to outweigh the negatives. And being gentle on yourself, just like you would be on your child around mistakes, is a great way to model that it's okay for them to come to you, because you are going to be thoughtful about it.
Can we talk about, you had mentioned the commercials, and we have zero control over that.
Right.
How do we choose what commercials or ads kids might see? What can we do in that situation?
There's really very little. So it's trying to find, you know, and if we're working with little kids, you know, if we're showing our kids things on YouTube, you know, using YouTube Kids generally is safer in terms of the ads that are going to pop up. Now, there may be ads for toys that you don't want to buy your kids, but you're less likely to see something violent or sexual. But even then, you know, there's so many people posting. Things do get through the controls that they have set up and the filters that they have set up. So you have to be careful. There's no real way to control it. When kids are on, you know, many of the social media platforms, there are all kinds of things popping up. And here's what we know. If you click on one thing, it is likely to give you more that is similar. And over time, the more time you spend, the more polarized, the more extreme, the more emotional that content is likely to become. That's what whistleblowers are saying, that the way that the algorithms, whatever those actually are, because we don't really understand them, and there are so many of them, whatever those algorithms are, the more time we spend, the more we see content that takes us further and further away from what our friends are posting and our friends are doing to what other people are doing, and to, you know, the most extreme, most polarized content. And that's what's so hard. And that's what we need to explain to our kids, that they might be engaging with something that is not accurate. And that's not necessarily, you know, an ad may pop up. We don't want them to click on those ads. We want to encourage them to stay away, to end them as soon as possible. We want to be there as much as possible to steer them away from things that are inappropriate. But of course, particularly with our teens who have their own phones, or they have their friends' phones, even if they don't have their own, they're getting into things sometimes when we are not around and able to see it.
Can we just talk about some of the benefits of social media? Because there's a lot of fear, but we've kind of hit a little bit on some benefits, but kind of as a whole, how do we highlight the positive?
Yeah, there are actually a lot. And so what we want to start with is the idea that, you know, the benefits are there for the kiddos who are mature enough to handle social media, whose parents are involved and engaged, or caregivers are involved and engaged and paying attention, who have the education and understanding about what might be happening on social media, and then who are using it responsibly. That means that it's balanced in their life. They're not only using social media, they're doing other things too. And when that's the case, there's a lot of good. It is an opportunity to connect with friends, particularly friends who maybe are far away, who they don't get to see day to day in person. It's an opportunity for them to find communities of shared interest. This is particularly true, you know, for, let's say, our LGBTQ youth who really need to find a community of support, or our neurodivergent youth, depending on what that diagnosis may be, what that need may be, they can find others like themselves. This can help people find areas of interest and passion. They might discover new hobbies, or they might be able to find others, you know, with similar hobbies who can really be, you know, role models and kind of co-conspirators in creation. And that's the thing, who will help them build their ideas and build their identity in a positive way. You know, social media can be a great place to experiment with who you are and to put out ideas and creativity and share what you've built in this world, whatever that may be. It may be an opportunity to connect with political views that are like your own, and to, you know, protest if you're concerned about something in a relatively safe way. There's a lot of good that's out there in social media. It's an opportunity, you know, to help people. One of the ways that I've used social media and my friends have is, you know, you have a lost pet in the area. It's a great way to share and say, hey, you know, keep your eyes out for this pet. That's a wonderful use of social media. So there are those things out there that are very positive. It's a way to learn. If you can access healthcare information that maybe you're not so comfortable talking to your parents about, particularly maybe in a rural area where you don't have access to all different kinds of healthcare, being able to find those communities and those groups, again, with the caveat that you have to make sure it's actually accurate and not inaccurate. And that's part of what's so hard.
How would a group find their group? Like how would a
child find their group?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, the good news is it's very easy to search, and the bad news is it's very easy to search, right? So if you're interested in something, you can start kind of finding, you start Googling, or you're in the social media and you type in an area of interest, you're going to get a whole bunch of groups that pop up. And so, you know, as parents, then we want to go back in and we want to help our kids figure out, okay, what groups are appropriate for you? And if we've set that stage for the conversation, what we're hoping is that we'll sit down with our kids. And this is something that we can really encourage with them, or even require, you know, that they're using social media, not locked in their room, but rather in a shared space. So that computer or those webcams are in a shared family space. And so you're seeing what your kids are doing and you're sitting with them and saying, okay, you know, you want to find a group around this area of interest. Let's look together. Let's read the group guidelines. Let's see what people are saying. Let's see if this is an appropriate group. You know, often also once you have a group of friends, you can see if they're trusted friends, who are they following? What are they doing? And that also helps to build, but those risks are always there. And so even with all of those positives, we have to have in mind, it could go wrong very quickly.
When does support become helicopter parenting with social media? And can we overdo it as a parent?
That is a great question. And I don't think it has a particularly easy answer. I really encourage parents to monitor their kids' social media use, but to be transparent about it. Where it really causes a problem is if we don't tell our kids, hey, we're checking your devices. Hey, we have parental controls on. Hey, you're not going to be able to download an app without getting permission from us first, because we're going to get an alert, you know, or we have Bark or some other parental control that's going to flag certain words, or, you know, we're going into your accounts and looking at them. We're following you, you know, on your different accounts. It's important to communicate to our kids what we're going to be doing, and even, again, to include them in that dialogue where you're deciding what is this going to look like, because then it's something that's collaborative. It's not just us standing over our kids. And what's hard is no matter how much we actually helicopter parent with social media, our kids go other places. So even in a household where there is none, our kids might access it on their friend's phone, or they may find a way through, you know, the different safeguards on the school computer, and they may get to the social media. So in some ways, saying nothing, you know, you can't have anything, may actually encourage them to do more behind our back. Whereas if we collaborate and we find a plan that works for our individual family, we may be more successful.
How do we model as parents that healthy online presence?
This is so key. You know, our kids are looking at what we do, and ultimately that probably matters a lot more than what we say. And so there are a bunch of things that we want to model. You know, kids have fear of missing out, and that's one of the things that becomes dangerous for them on social media, is the sense that, you know, everyone else has more, everyone else is doing more, everyone's life is happy, and they're not recognizing that, you know, every other kid is also taking, you know, 50 photos before they post it online, or they are, you know, using filters to make their bodies or their faces or their clothes look different. Same thing with celebrities that they might be following, or the kids, you know, don't realize that the other kids are only posting, or other people that they follow, the good parts of their life and the highlights, which may have only been a moment in time. And parents, you know, we can change that for them by being a lot more real, by putting a photo that isn't perfect, by sharing, you know, moments of happiness and moments of sadness, moments of joy and moments where we're struggling and maybe looking out, you know, to our friends for some help. So if we're careful about what we curate or not curate in this case, that models it for our kids. There's also, you know, what are we saying? Are we putting ourselves down? Are we, you know, worrying so much about our body image that we're teaching our kids to do the same? Are we, you know, being aggressive in the language that we're using? Are we being provocative in the language that we're using? You know, we want to follow our kids and have our kids follow us. And just like other areas of our life, we want to make sure that what we're showing them through our own behavior is what we would like to see them do. The other way that we can model is by modeling good screen use in general. So having balance in our own lives, not having our phone at our side every second. Having times of the day where we all, as a family, put the devices away and tune into each other. Doing activities as a family where the phones or the other devices are not present. Getting out, getting fresh air and movement. You know, what we have seen over and over again is that exercise is very protective against mental health concerns involved with screen and social media use. So as a family, getting out and exercising. We also know, as I've said a few times, that balance is key. So making sure, you know, that you're not only using social media, that you're not only on your phone all day, but that you're getting up and interacting with people in person. And that was harder during the pandemic, of course, that you are, you know, going out and doing things in the world, real things in the world. And, you know, that we are potentially putting away or locking away devices for the whole family at night to model good sleep hygiene, which is also so key. So those things that we do every day set the tone for what our kids do.
So that just kind of brings us to our topic in terms of social media and mental health. And, you know, you talk about a curated feed for our kiddos and even for us. And so I think it's really easy for adults and even kids to get in this trap of everybody's life is perfect. It's easy. It's this, it's that, whatever that loop may be. And even now, just how there could be a party and then it's on social media and maybe you weren't invited, right? So how do we mitigate some of that as parents? How can we kind of build that self-esteem within our kids when it's everywhere? It's so hard.
So this is one of the keys, right? Social media is there all the time. It doesn't go away. And what we're seeing in all of our kids is that, you know, they want to go, and that's how they're measuring their popularity. That's how they're measuring their success. They want to go on and see how many likes do I have? How many follows do I have? How many comments do I have compared to other people? And they're worrying about, you know, if I post this, are people going to like it? You know, are people going to respond to this? And this is really hard. Or again, that fear of missing out, you know, okay, I might have missed this party, or they look like they were having fun, I wasn't included. And this is a difference from when we were growing up. Those things might be happening, but it wasn't in our face all the time. And the hard part is there's not an easy way to mitigate those difficulties. It's going to happen, but this goes back again to creating that safe space for our kids to come to us when this is happening, when they are hurting, when they're feeling left out, that they know they can come, they can talk to us. We're going to help them work through those feelings. We're going to help them, you know, figure out, how do I want to handle this? You know, what am I experiencing right now and why? What's it like to be left out? If they're feeling lonely, how do we start to help them build a sense of community? If they're feeling, you know, that they're not included with their friends, how do we find them, you know, some other friends or some other interests that could potentially build friends in their day-to-day life to get them, you know, feeling more confident? There's not a super easy answer to this. And, you know, along with this, what we find is because of that need to check, because it's there all the time, kids are often, they're walking away, and this happens to us as adults too, they're walking away from social media and they're feeling anxious, their cortisol levels are building, and then they go back to the social media, and especially if they hear a ding or they get a like, and that the dopamine rises and it feels good, and then they walk away again, and that anxiety, what are people saying, what are they doing, am I missing something, is there. And that creates such a negative cycle that can lead to a very high level of anxiety, that can lead to depression for kiddos if they are not, you know, getting the attention that they would like to get there. And so this takes us back to building a life outside of what's happening on the screen.
It's interesting you say that. So when I run carpool with my personal kids in the carpool, if it seems like if I automatically, everybody has a phone out and then the car is silent. And I'm always like, put your phones away, be human, talk to each other. And they're like, oh, Wendy, Miss Taylor, whatever they call me. But it's like, they know when they get in the car that I'm like, be human, talk to each other.
Yeah, and it can be hard because, you know, this is a different generation of kids who, you know, I've heard kids talk about being on play dates basically, and they're sitting there and they're using their phones, sometimes actually to talk to each other while they're sitting next to each other. And, you know, as parents, that's such a scary, troubling thing. And to them, it's just natural. And so, you know, we're moving into a generation where phones are going to be a part of it. But we want to try to balance it again. We want to try to say, okay, you know, your phones are going to be there. All right, now we're going to find a time. Maybe it's in the car, maybe it's not, because it's hard for you to be face to face if you're driving. But we're all going to put it down. We're going to talk to each other. We're going to do an activity together that doesn't involve a phone. We're going to play a game. We're going to tell a story. We're going to go out for ice cream. We're going to do something, and we're going to leave our phones behind. And honestly, that's hard for us, right? As parents, we find ourselves drawn to it too. And so this is where it goes back to. We want to set that tone as much as possible and make sure our kids understand what are those dangers by talking about it, making it a regular part of conversation, normalizing that, hey, there's great things and you love it, but there's also some concerns and we've got to come back to them and you need to be aware to stay safe.
Some warning signs that a parent may notice when you talk about that negative cycle loop in terms of anxiety and then dopamine. How can we as parents notice it? And then what can we do to kind of, I think you're explaining this in terms of, not I think, I know we're having this conversation of what we can do to reduce that, but what are some warning signs?
Yeah, so the warning signs, they're not necessarily unique to social media. They're warning signs of, you know, mental health concern or distress in general. So we're looking for things like changes, right? Changes in eating, changes in sleeping, changes in friend group, changes in how a child is behaving, changes in how a child is dressing, changes for the negative in how they're doing in school. If we start to see decreasing grades, kids who are isolating more, wanting to spend more time in their room. And of course, many teenagers want that. So we have to look at it as a whole picture. You know, are they coming out? Are they engaging with the family? You know, looking for signs perhaps that they're getting more and more anxious. They can't sit still. They're running to their screen over and over again, and they're having more trouble than they ever did before separating from it. And that's tough too, because many kids have trouble separating, but an increase in that difficulty. If we're seeing that they're withdrawing from real world interactions, that they're spending less time with friends that they would have wanted to spend time with before, or they're spending less time engaged in activities that they once loved, that would be a sign. With cyberbullying, which we haven't touched on much yet, you know, the signs that we want to look for are all of those. And then also, you know, if we see that our kids seem particularly nervous when they do get a text message or they get a ding on social media, if they look nervous, agitated, worried, if they are, you know, finishing on the screen and walking away seeming very upset by something, if they're starting to feel nervous about going to school, or they're saying that they don't want to go, or more and more they're complaining about stomach aches or headaches or other things to stay home. These are generally signs, and obviously there are bigger ones like lying, cheating, drugs and alcohol use. These are the things where we know there's really, really a problem. But even those more subtle signs tell us something is going on. Maybe social media difficulties, may not be. And there's all kinds of social media difficulties. It could be something like the cyberbullying. It could also be, you know, where we're seeing more of an addictive tendency where our kids can't get away from it. It could be that, you know, they're having trouble concentrating on their schoolwork because they want to be on social media and they're feeling drawn back there, and then they can't get their work done, and so they're struggling because of the addictive quality and that desire to go back. Kids are often sneaking phones at night. And, you know, so this is a sign that they're finding the phone that you've put away at night, or, you know, you hear them, you're peeking in and they're awake and they're using their phone. That is a sign of not necessarily, you know, that they're struggling with it in terms of feeling like they're suffering, but their sleep is suffering, which is negative for their well-being. And they may be starting to show signs that they're beginning to become addicted to it and can't really break away even at night. And that's why in some families, we really do recommend take all of the devices, put them away under lock and key at night, put them in a safe, because it's so crucial that kids sleep for their mental health and their well-being.
Can you explain what cyberbullying is, or what it looks like, and how would we as parents or professionals cue in of some of that?
So cyberbullying looks like the emotional bullying that we would see, you know, in real life. It isn't going to be the physical bullying. It could happen at the same time at school, but cyberbullying could be anything from, you know, leaving a child out, just consistently, you know, treating them as if they are not present. It could be, you know, putting negative comments on their feed. It could be criticizing them. It could be getting other kids to say negative things. This can happen in a text chain. You know, it can also happen on any social media. And, you know, often it could be one person or it could be a group of kids who get pulled into, you know, making another child feel left out, making another child feel badly about who they are, about what they're posting. And there are different levels of, you know, of what that may look like. It can be very subtle or it can be very extreme. The snubbing is, you know, often very subtle. The kids might talk about feeling ghosted. You know, that can be very subtle. It can take time to see, or it may be, you know, much more aggressive, where the child is actually being actively belittled with negative comments. It can be as extreme as people telling them, you know, go kill yourself. You know, it can get really, really bad. And so what can we do to mitigate it? This goes back to, you know, we want to be monitoring. We want to see what our kids are posting and how people are responding to it. We want to be following our kids. And again, we are not going to know for sure, do they have some other account somewhere that we can't see? So we want to be looking at the signs in real life too. You know, do they engage with us in the way that they always did? Are they themselves? You know, yes, there are developmental changes because they're getting older, but at their core, you know, are they themselves? Are we starting to see those changes that we talked about before, you know, where they're not eating, not sleeping, changing friends, changing clothes, seeming more anxious, not actually wanting to be on their phones, or seeming so connected to it that they just can't let go? These are the things that we would be looking for the most.
Can we as parents work with other parents to kind of help this? And what would that look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, anytime we can have a network of support for our kids, it's great. Because, you know, maybe we don't see something, but another, you know, your kid has a friend and their parent who you've gotten to know sees something, and they can pick up the phone and call you and say, hey, Wendy, you know, I'm really worried. I saw this and I wanted to give you a heads up. So having that network of support, be it, you know, teachers or other community members or, you know, other caregivers who we get to know, and, you know, we know our kids and we know their friends and we're talking to each other to say, you know, let's keep an eye on this. Let's see what we're seeing. If you're monitoring your kids' text chains and you see another child, you know, talking about self-harm or suicide or sex or anything else that might be a concern, eating disorder type behavior, and being able to flag that and reach out to the other parents or the school if you don't know the child to say, hey, I'm worried about this kid. And the more people you have who are doing that and talking to each other, the better, because that's more safeguards. Those are more people with their eyes on the kids having those conversations and being watchful.
Have you seen success, or what does that look like when a family has reached out to the school?
It depends very much on the school. It you know, I've seen schools really rally to help, and I've seen the opposite. And so it's not universal. You know, I know that there are schools that are starting to teach about digital safety as early as kindergarten and first grade at an age appropriate level. And, you know, that's wonderful. And they're having the conversations there. And that's great, because the more, again, the more the community is educating kids and normalizing, like, hey, you need to be aware of this and this and this and this, you know, that there is content that could be sexual, that there is content that could be violent, that there is content that could try to pull you in, you know, to self-harm or harm others, or to behave, you know, in ways that are dangerous to yourself and others, that there is content, you know, that is pro-eating disorders. These are some of the big, you know, very scary things that are out there. If the schools are teaching that, that's great. If we see a cyberbullying situation and we let the school know and they intervene, they, you know, start to put in whatever bullying program that they use in school, if they bring that into, okay, if this is happening, you know, on the internet, if this is happening in text messages or in social media, we're going to intervene as well. And the kids know that. That's another thing that is kind of making them pause and stop and, you know, say, maybe I shouldn't do this, or helping them feel supported. The problem is, and we know this, right? There have always been bullies, and there likely always will be. And so we go back to, we have to talk to our kids. We have to teach them, you know, how to treat other people so that they are not the bully. We want to teach them the dangers of what they could do to another child if they behave in this way. And then if they are being bullied, we want them to be able to come to us because we've created that sense of safety. And, you know, maybe they're more comfortable with the school counselor. Maybe they're more comfortable with their therapist. Maybe they're more comfortable, you know, with a member of their religious community. You know, we don't know who that person is going to be, but the more safe people in their life that they might be able to go to, the better, because we can't stop these things from happening. We can help our kids learn how to manage them and know that they have a support system around them in order to manage it once it happens.
How can we have a conversation with our kids to be in tune with their feelings more so that if something's coming up, whether it's anxiety, it's depression, it's whatever it is, you know, I mean, it does correlate, right? Social media and that mental health. And that's why we're talking today. How can we as parents kind of set the stage of bringing in that feeling of mental health, and what does that mean? And what does that look like? And keeping that conversation open so that our kids feel comfortable coming to us and being like, I don't feel good, or whatever that looks like for them at that age.
So that's a great question, because kids are so different in their willingness to talk about feelings. Some kids will talk about feelings all the time. Some kids do not want to talk about them at all, right? They don't want to talk about their day. They don't want to talk about anything. Even within a household, you mm-hmm. can have different personalities. And so this is really about, again, that sense of safety. And so maybe you're coming together and you're not directly talking about feelings, but you're spending time doing something that is quality. Ideally, non-screen based, child-led activities, no matter their age, right? What do they want to be doing with that time spent with you? We often are recommending every parent spend one-on-one time with their child or children every day. And that may only be 10 minutes. You have three kids, let's say, and you know, you're a busy parent or caregiver, you know, you might not have a lot of time, but you spend 10 minutes and you let them kind of lead what they're doing. They may not communicate with words, but they may communicate with play, or they may communicate, you know, through their body language. You might pick up on, you know, they just look exhausted. They're sulking, they're slumped over. You might start to notice they're not quite themselves, right? They're not engaging in the way they would. They're not, you know, wanting to be present with me. They are, you know, just seeming like they're down, or they're more revved up, they're more anxious. When we spend that time with them, even if they're not talking about feelings, which ideally they would, then they're showing us in some other way. If we want them to talk about feelings, we want to talk about ours, not overwhelmingly and not, you know, ever in a blaming way. We don't want to talk about like, you made me feel this way, but rather like normalizing mistakes are okay. Big feelings are okay. You know, you are welcome in this house when you are sad, angry, happy, joyful, whatever that emotion may be, I'm going to be there. And that's what we go back to the co-regulation, right? We stay present. We don't send our kids necessarily for a time out when they are acting up, but maybe more of what we call a time in. Okay, let's go to a place together in the house, or maybe you can't move them. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to be with you through this big emotion and show you I've got you, right? I am here when you are having a hard time, just like I am here when things are going well. And that may not necessarily be through a conversation, but through our calm presence. And that is so key, because when we're showing our kids time and time again, we're showing up for them and we're going to be there for any emotion or any experience, it allows that conversation or that modeling of nonverbal cues that is going to let us know something's wrong.
Personalize our social media rules to fit the maturity levels of our kid?
That is a great
question. Plural kids.
Yeah. That is a great question, because, you know, there is a lot of conversation right now. The Surgeon General said 13 is too young, right? Which is generally the age that social media says, you know, you have to be 13 to get an account. Now, of course, our kids are figuring out, oh, wait, I can just change my birthday. There's no checks and balances there. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation on both sides about what would be good about more checks and balances, what would be bad about it, how can our kids kind of get around that, and kids are getting around it. But the reality is there's not a perfect age for social media. You have kids of all ages who have different levels of maturity, different developmental needs, in different monitoring, different awareness that changes whether or not, you know, they are ready for social media. There's not a perfect age to figure that out. It's not cut and dry. And what's so scary is sometimes we don't know for sure as parents. We think our child is mature enough and able to handle it. and they're not, or vice versa. We think that they can't and they absolutely can. And so, you know, it's often starting small. It's deciding, you know, through your research. And I recommend Common Sense Media is great because they actually go through on their website all of the different platforms and kind of what parents should know about them. So picking maybe one platform that you know your child's friends are on and that your child wants to use, and then using it with your child, helping them learn it, showing them kind of the ins and outs, what's safe, what's not, helping them look at the different content that's there, what are their friends posting, and as much as possible, using that social media with them early on. And it may be, you know, that you have it not on their phones. Again, we don't know what they're doing on someone else's, but on yours or on a shared family computer where you're looking together, and that's how you begin and you see, how does that go? Is my child able to use it responsibly? What are they searching? And then you slowly build from there. It may not be just kind of the deep dive into everything at once.
How does that work with social media and brain development, like specifically with, say, communication or social skills, emotional skills?
Yeah.
Do you have some real life examples of that?
Yeah, I can try to think of some. So, you know, what we see is that, or what we know about brain development in kids is that the frontal lobe, which is the thinking part of the brain, the part that kind of controls everything else and helps us make good decisions and solve problems, develops far more slowly than the emotional center of the brain. So for our kids, for our teens, they are really guided by emotion even more than adults are. And this is a big part of what makes social media use so challenging, is when you have this content that's out there that might be, you know, really extreme, really polarized or inappropriate. Again, you know, sexual, violent, pro-eating disorder content, self-harm or suicide content, our kids may be swept in, right? You've probably been on social media. I know I have. And something pops up and you're like, oh my gosh, that is so gross and I cannot look away. Or, oh my gosh, that is so troubling. You know, I can't believe what I'm seeing right now. And you can't look away. And that happens to our kids too. And if they click on that and they watch, then something even more extreme pops up and more extreme pops up. And what's hard is that emotion center of their brain rules everything, whether it's positive or negative. And they're going to be drawn to it, whether it's positive or negative. And they may not have developed enough, you know, frontal lobe ability to say, wait a minute, stop. You know, this is not what I want to see. Or hang on, this content, this doesn't look right. There's something wrong here. I'm not sure this is accurate. Or, oh, this content is too violent. I shouldn't be watching. This is going to disturb me. Or, well, these people, they're seeming to be kind and gentle and they're pulling me in, but they want me to start starving myself, or they want me to hurt myself, or they're encouraging me to be aggressive. And, you know, kids are also by nature, for the same reason in brain development, more impulsive. They're more likely to act based on, you know, in a moment, like, hey, oh, that sounds like fun. Or, oh, you know, my friends or this person is encouraging me to engage in this behavior, and they'll think I'm really cool if I do this very risky thing that puts me or someone else, you know, at risk. And they're not stopping to think about those very real consequences. So they're putting themselves in danger. They might be putting others in danger. They may not realize until much later that the content that they're looking at is encouraging them to eat in ways that are damaging to their body, or, you know, helping or causing them to feel worse about their body image, or to, you know, to self-harm, or to, you know, start to push away friends that they care about, you know, that they're maybe being encouraged to bully or belittle others, because they get swept up in sort of that need to please peers, particularly popular peers, or, you know, others who they come across who they kind of look at and they're like, wow, you know, you seem really cool. I want to make you happy. I want to do what you're doing. And because of how their brains are developing, they're not necessarily stopping to think about those consequences.
What are some tips that you could give? I'm going to start with professionals first, to kind of improve that sense of a village that we can create to support mental health as it aligns with social media or online activities.
So I think mental health professionals, tutors, you know, anybody working with kids, right? Executive functioning coaches, teachers, Again, we go back to caregivers, but really anybody in the community who's working with kids to actually have these conversations, to talk about it. Kids are on social media. They often do want to talk about it. And so, you know, anywhere and everywhere that they're hearing the messages of, hey, there's good stuff and there's also danger, the better. And all of those people really looking for those signs that the kid is having a hard time. You know, we have seen that as much as kids don't want to step away, when they finally do, a lot of them feel less anxious. At the same time, there are a lot of kids who feel like their entire social media use is very, very positive. And often those are the kids who have a lot of balance in their life, who are interacting more with friends or within their areas of interest. And so, you know, everyone working with our kids can kind of get a pulse on that. You know, what are you doing on social media? What are you looking at? What are your friends doing? Maybe your kid doesn't want to talk about themselves. Maybe that's too intense, but what are their friends doing? They may talk about that. What's going on with them? You can get an idea of who your child is or who somebody else's child is if you're working with them, you know, as a professional, by those conversations about their friends and what friends are doing and what they're concerned about with their friends and what they wish they could do that their friends are doing. That gives us a lot of insight into what might be going on in that world.
That's great. That is great in terms of flipping it, in terms of what are your friends doing? What do you think about that? What are some tips then for parents?
I'm not sure they're particularly different than what we've already talked about. You know, for parents, it really is starting the conversations as early as possible. I really encourage parents to pay attention to, you know, recommendations that are coming out on screen and social media use from trusted sources. It might be Academy of Pediatrics. It might be APA, you know, psychology. It might be looking at Common Sense Media and their updates all the time. I encourage parents to research the different parental controls that are out there. I encourage parents to also learn about, you know, what are the ways that kids are getting around, you know, the parental controls, because part of what kids are finding are these other apps that hide the social media apps on their phone, or they can go on and they can actually learn, you know, how do I short circuit, you know, these different regulations on my phone or on social media. And so parents need to know about these things, and it's always changing. It's not concrete. It's not like you learn once and then you're done. You have to always be paying attention to what's happening with social media. What are, you know, the trendy apps? You know, it used to be Facebook, now not so much. Kids are on TikTok, kids are on Instagram, kids are on Snapchat. It is different. What are those recommended ages? And then does that actually work with my child's developmental needs and how much I can monitor them? What are the current trends in terms of, you know, what are kids getting in trouble for? What are, you can find a lot of information about like the newest challenge that's coming up for kids. You know, it might be, most recently I read kids were being taught how to steal Kia cars. And, you know, there was a challenge not that long ago about vandalizing schools. And then of course there are more dangerous challenges than that. So what are those trends? What's out there? Parents should be reading and learning, and community members should be reading and learning and trying to stay on up on this as possible. And that's actually really hard to do because there is so much out there and the landscape changes so quickly. And that's where, again, as a community, we can help each other. You know, maybe if you have a group of parents or caregivers who are friends, being able to say, you know, I'm going to monitor this, I'm going to monitor this, and I'm going to monitor this, and let's talk. That may be a way to do it.
As we kind of wind down, what did I not know enough to ask that I should have asked?
Oh, that's a good question. Let me think about that for a minute. I think an understanding just the full scope of this, that there are, and you touched on it all, but that there are really positive aspects of social media and there are really negative aspects of social media. And the reality is it is not going away. And so we have to learn to live in the world that has both those pros and those cons, and just continuing to be very aware and talk to our kids. I've said it over and over and over again, but that tends to be the bottom line, is talking to your kids, creating that safe space for your kids. I think that nothing is foolproof. We have to remember that we might be doing everything right and our kids may still run into trouble. You know, no matter how much we're doing to try to protect them, they might run into trouble. And so that's a really scary, hard thing as parents. We want to recognize that the research is still very new. And so it doesn't all agree with each other. You know, there's some research that says kids who spend more time on social media are more likely to be anxious and depressed. And then research says, well, it's actually the anxious and depressed kids who are spending that time. They were already anxious and depressed, and this is giving them an outlet. There's research about why social media might be addicting, and that there may be changes to the brain that happen by spending a lot of time on social media. And then other research that says it's not actually so much about the time, it's about the quality of the use. And if they're using it in a way that suggests addiction, that is when we start to see those brain changes and those problems. Whereas the kids who are spending time but using it in a balanced way in their life, they're okay. As I mentioned before, that things like exercise and time spent in other activities is very protective for these mental health concerns. And potentially being aware, there's some research that says, you know, it's minority kids who are most at risk. And that could be girls, that could be ADHDers, because they tend to be by nature a little bit more impulsive, or autistic kiddos who may be more vulnerable. LGBTQ youth may be more at risk. Black and brown kids may be more at risk. Kids who have come from a background of lower socioeconomic status may be more at risk. And just being aware, but there's no one who is not potentially at risk. Our boys, the research says that they may be more at risk for aggression, while girls are more at risk for self-esteem issues and eating disorders. And yet, boys also, there's a lot out there on bigorexia, you know, having to become more and more muscular. And so it can be a challenge for everyone. And we just want to try to be as aware as possible as parents so that we can help our kids navigate this very new landscape that was not there when we were children.
I think we just hit the tip of the iceberg in this conversation. But I would say definitely being aware and being comfortable with having those conversations with your own kids. And then for our kids that may not have that network within their family as professionals, whether it's in a school or outside of the school, having that awareness so that we can help do our part to guide our youth is incredibly important.
Incredibly. Yes. It takes the whole community. You know, it would be great if we could rely on the social media companies to figure this out and to keep things safe for our kids. And, you know, I would absolutely encourage them. You know, I don't think that any individual involved in social media wants to hurt our kids. And yet collectively, that's a lot of what's happening. This content is being created knowing the kids are going to be drawn to it, because social media, they're businesses, right? They want to draw people in. They want users. They want people to come back. And they're not necessarily caring what age they are or thinking about what age they are. And that content is there and they know it, even if any individual would say, I don't want to hurt a child. Of course not. And so as much as we want to rely on social media to fix the problem, and we can fight and we can encourage and we can legislate, we have to look at the community as a whole. It's everybody's job to talk to our kids, to make our kids safe, to put those safeguards in place, to help our kids find balance in their lives. It's not any one person who can do this. It is everyone working together.
How do folks find you?
They can find us on our website, which is wbma.cc. A little bit of a different website. That's a great way to learn about me and our practice and what we are doing.
And we'll also have that in the show notes. So, such a pleasure. Thank you for taking your time out of the day. And I hope this touches on folks that they can start to bring awareness and have a better conversation to support our kids as they're going and navigating a time that we as adults didn't necessarily have to navigate.
Thank you, Wendy.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials. Looking for free tips? Head over to learningessentialsedu.com and you can download free tips to prepare for an IEP meeting, plus bonus questions to ask. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide an individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching, educational therapy, and BrainCamp, our executive function support model. If you are a parent, I've got you covered. Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com and I can walk you through that IEP journey. Mm-hmm.